Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is John Berendt, who reads from and discusses the paperback edition of The City of Fallen Angels, published by Penguin. In the weeks to come, we have Francine Matthews, James McGreevy, Sina Jeter-Nasland, T.A. Barron, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. In 1961, after graduating from Harvard University, where he was the editor of the Harvard Lampoon, John Berendt was hired as an associate editor of Esquire magazine. He left Esquire in 1969 to write for television, first for David Frost and then for Dick Cavett. From 1977 until 1979, he served as editor of New York Magazine. Following that, he worked as a freelance writer and wrote a monthly column for Esquire. 12 years ago, Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil began its record-breaking four-year run on the New York Times bestseller list. John's unique style of nonfiction brought the dark mystique of Savannah so startlingly to life for millions of people that tourism to Savannah increased by 46%. Of course, 12 years ago, we were all left craving more, wondering where Mr. Berendt would resurface. We were most pleased when he drew our attention to Venice. We're delighted that John Berendt has returned to the Tattered Cover this evening to present the new edition of The City of Falling Angels. Would you please join me now in making him feel welcome?
Thank you very much. I thought I'd begin by talking about, before I talk about this book or Midnight, about a book that's meant more to me than any other in my life, and you probably haven't heard of it. It's a novel by the name of Small World. It was published in 1951. The author, Carol DeShare. She was a housewife, and she wrote about her own family in novel form, and she was her husband and two children. In the middle of the book, her two-year-old son begins tearing up books, destroying them. It's a family with a lot of books, a very literary family. But at that time, the child psychologists were advocating something called positive suggestion, which meant you didn't spank the child. You simply substituted something else for the child to destroy instead of books. So she, whenever he grabbed a book, she would hand newspapers and magazines to him. But he wasn't interested. Only books. So she thought she'd sweeten the pot, and she went out and bought some little trinkets, wind-up toys and building blocks. And when he got his hands on the book, she would give him one of those. He wasn't stupid. He realized all he had to do was look at a book, and he would get a little present. And one time, he actually got past his mother and destroyed, utterly destroyed, a library book. And she lost her temper and slapped his hand very hard. And he never tore up another book after that. Now, I bring that up not to introduce the topic of spare the rod, spoil the child, or the sanctity of the published word, but to introduce myself. The author of the book, Carol DeShare, is my mother. So you can see I started out in life destroying books, and I've done my best to make up for it ever since. I was very proud of my mother, in fact. I was 11 years old when the book came out, and I was the only person in my class whose mother had written the book. But more than that, it showed me, demonstrated to me for the first time that real life could be written down and published between hardcovers for everybody to read. And I thought one day I might want to do the same thing. My father also played a role in turning me away from the destruction of books toward the creation of books by reading to me and to my sister before we went to bed at night. And he didn't just read us children's stories. He read us books like A Tale of Two Cities, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, Robinson Crusoe, etc. My father also wrote a book, but his is very different from my mother's. He began writing it when I was in my teens, and it was at first a letter to me, a philosophical letter to me. And he went on, and he wrote and he wrote, and decades went by, and it evolved into a book on quantum mechanics and epistemology. And when he was 93, after about 40 years of writing it, of more than that, he finished. So I rushed out and approached my publisher to see if they were interested in publishing it. They said it was far too complex for a layman. And the academic press, while they said it's all fascinating, it did not cover enough new ground in order to be for a specialist. So I published it myself. I published 50 copies. And he actually had one in his hand when he died at the age of 93. I did not go directly into books, as you heard briefly. I swerved and found myself in magazines, having worked on the Harvard Lampoon. And then I was hired by Esquire right out of college. And it was in the 60s, and it was a wonderful time to be on the staff of Esquire because that was the period in which the new journalism was being born in Esquire. Tom Wolfe called it the new journalism in a wonderful essay that he wrote several years later that was the introduction to an anthology of new journalism pieces. And what it was very simple. New journalism is and was a style of narrative used for reportage. And it's simply the style used by literary figures for novels and short stories, which is to say that the story progressed through a succession of scenes, an extended dialogue, and much sharper descriptions of people. For instance, you don't just say so-and-so said something. It's you describe the facial expression, maybe a facial tic while they said it, the responses of people in the room, the mood, so that the piece of reportage reads either like a short story or a novel. It's as simple as that. And I would say if I had to... The first new journalism piece, and people may disagree with me, but I think it's a major piece, was appeared in Esquire in 1960. It was Esquire wanted to cover the 1960 Democratic National Convention. The only problem was Esquire had a lead time of about 4 months, which meant that all the networks would beat them by 4 months. They were covering it on the scene. The newspapers, daily newspapers, came up with their stories the next day. The news weeklies the next week. But Esquire wouldn't come out with the issue, with the story for 4 months. So they decided we've got to do something that sets our coverage apart from all the others. So that something will be so different that it will be readable 4 months from the actual fact. And so what they did was they hired Norman Mailer to be their reporter. And he wrote a very long and wonderful piece, which was totally fresh when it was read, I think it was the October issue, maybe even the November issue of 1960. What he did was he wrote it as a novelist with his novelist's eye. So, and I more or less grew up at Esquire working with authors who were writing this kind of literary nonfiction, so to speak, creative nonfiction. And it's the way I've always written. And the... two books I've written have been called nonfiction novels. For a while, when Midnight was called a novel, I would correct people. Even Clint Eastwood, when he did the movie, on the credits, it said, based on a novel by John Barron. And I had them correct that, but 800 copies of the movie have novel in it, so I've just given up. It's novel. My second book is dedicated to Harold Hayes and Clay Felker. Harold Hayes was the brilliant editor of Esquire at the time, and he was one of the most brilliant teachers I've ever had. And Clay Felker was the features editor at the time, and he and Harold fought it out for who would be editor of Esquire. Harold Hayes won, so Clay Felker went out and founded New York Magazine, which many years later I became the editor of. I was very happy doing magazines. It was, even though there was a four-month lead time, it was fast compared to books. So I didn't have any interest in writing a book. But after a while, years, I realized I could never show my work to anybody because it would always be thrown into the trash after a few weeks. Magazines get thrown away. And I thought, well, it'd be nice to write a book. Then I'd have a calling card, something I could show for my work. And I met new people. I could say, oh, by the way, I wrote this book, and maybe you'd be interested in giving them a copy. Calling card sort of thing. But more than that, I realized that working for magazines, I never was able to get very deeply into anything. I had a monthly column in Esquire for 12 years, and I would research the topic for about three weeks, and then I'd write the column, and then on to something else the next month. So you don't get very deeply into anything. I was skimming the surface, and it was ultimately unsatisfying. So I knew that I would have to write a book if I wanted to wallow in something, and I had just been to Savannah 3 years before on a trip that I described in Midnight. And I loved Savannah. It really was the most remarkably beautiful town I'd ever been in. Total surprise to me. Here I was, a New Yorker, charmed and dazzled by this beautiful city and by the people I met. Very strange people. And I love eccentric people. To me, they're far more interesting than the rest of us because they're creative. They decide who they want to be, and then they are that person. So they're artists whose masterpiece is themselves. And sometimes that takes a bit of daring because if you're an eccentric, you're outside the norm. And that can be not appreciated in some places. But in Savannah, people love eccentrics. They love to gossip. And what do you gossip about? Other people. The stranger the behavior, the better the gossip. The people who are being gossiped about because they're odd know that they're appreciated, if only because they give someone something to talk about. What charmed me about Savannah is, beside their wonderful humor, the ironic sense of humor, was the way they spoke to each other, the way they communicated. A very colorful, vivid form of communication. We Northerners, we tell each other information, give each other information. The Southerners, particularly Savannians, tell stories. That's the difference. And I've said this enough times, and somebody once challenged me to come up with a sentence that we would say in New York as compared with the way you might say it in Savannah, and I have done that. And the sentence is as follows. In New York, we would say something very direct. We would say, before going out, Mrs. Jones put on her coat. Perfectly straightforward. You diagram that sentence in a straight line. Savannah, it would never do. You'd be thought a bore. You would have to say something like, before going out, Mrs. Jones put on the coat her third husband gave her before he committed suicide. I promise you, everything comes with an extra bit of information like that, and it's usually very poignant information. And there's a bit of a dark humor, but it is part of your humor, actually. Because I took... I had a lot of... eccentric people in my book. One critic observed that I had cherry-picked my characters, and of course that's true. But I wasn't the first person to people a book with odd characters. There were some very, very respected authors who've done it too. Robert Penn Warren wrote that the author is under no obligation to present a balanced view of life. Flattering yourself and your community is a mighty poor way to write anything or to be a good citizen for that matter. The concern of the writer is in the defects. By writing about freaks, outcasts, weirdos, and oddballs, you make a comment on the average man. Write a story about a man with one arm, and you're making a comment about men who have two. Somebody once asked him what he meant by freaks. He said, by freaks, I mean anyone you know who's worth writing about. Flannery O'Connor was accused, as always accused, of not writing about ordinary Georgians. And she said, of course I don't write about ordinary Georgians. I write for ordinary Georgians, but I write about grotesques. And she said, grotesque characters distort reality. And in doing so, they dramatize a point that I wish to make. So at any rate, I felt that it was perfectly all right to write about the people I like best, and they're the eccentric people. What I'm often asked about is how I write. How a writer writes is, I suppose, of some interest to people who read their writings. I discovered, because of all my time working at magazines, that I'm a far better editor than writer. I'm an okay writer, but I'm a really good editor. So I write a sentence or a paragraph. Usually it's only a sentence, and I get that far, and I think that won't do. So then I change words, I move things around, and before I know it, I've edited the thing into far better shape. So, and Truman Capote once said that good writing is rewriting, and I think he's right. So I write very slowly. I'm the kind of writer who can't leave a sentence until it's just about right. And then the same is true of a paragraph. I have writer friends who can just turn out 2,000 pages and then go back and fix and turn and throw out and add to it. I can't do that. So I have to move very slowly. And I often am reminded of a story involving Oscar Wilde. He was at dinner one night, and someone said to him, "Oscar, what did you do all day?" He said, "I wrote all day long. In the morning, I put a comma in. In the afternoon, I took it out." It never got that bad. But I must say that I did sometimes tear up a whole day's work, but you never know. before I started writing Midnight, one of my writer friends gave me a good bit of advice. He said, make the reader fall in love with the narrator. Something I hadn't thought about. But what he meant was, if you're going to walk through a book holding the hand of the reader for 400 pages, you better be likable. A lot of writers make sort of snide, witty remarks at the expense of their characters and the place or the customs, whatever. And the reader is slowly turned off and after a while can't stand the writer. So writers should be somehow, as I say, likable and admirable and smart and observant so that the reader feels pleased to be in his or her company. By the same token, a writer has to fall in love with his characters. And I can tell you, with the two books I've written, I have fallen in love with all my characters, even the ones I do not like, because they are providing me with wonderful stories, characters to write about. They're giving me material, even if they don't want to or don't know they're doing it. So I really, and it shows, my interest in the writers, in the places, in the stories, has to show to the reader. If I were bored by a character, I think that would show. I've learned to write down my first impressions. If I'm out of an evening while I'm writing a book somewhere and something happens, I have to write it down right away because I might not remember the next day or because after a while, what I thought was so unusual becomes routine and I can't remember what it was that, as an outsider, I noticed was so strange. So I always carry a little 3x5 notebook in my back pocket. And I take it out when something occurs, and I either do it in plain sight of everybody or where they can't see. And the reason I do that, the first time I realized what was happening about that first impressions was when I was in the Army right after college. I was in the Army, and I was coming out of the mess hall the first day that I was there at Fort Polk. And we were told we had to scrape our trays into each of two garbage cans. And one was labeled inedible garbage, and the other was labeled edible garbage. I thought that was the most hilarious thing in my life. And I wrote letters home, and I mentioned all that. You know, we're eating edible garbage. Very funny. 2 weeks later, I was coming out of the mess hall. Somebody says, I left my helmet over somewhere, and I can't find it. And I said, it's over there by the edible garbage. So it had become routine to me. And I was beginning to use the terminology that I first found extraordinary. I had fallen into the trap of using it. So if you write something down right away, it will be fresh for when you sit down to write the book. Another rule that I've sort of made for myself is not to send readers to the dictionary because it becomes extremely annoying. One word maybe, but even so, there's another word you could use that's just as good that everybody knows the meaning of. There's one writer I love who does send me the dictionary all the time, and I forgive him. Cormac McCarthy tends to use... geological terminology for a reason, so I forgive him. I pay attention to the rhythm. it's not enough to use the right words to create the images that you want to transmit into somebody's mind. Actually, writing is the creation of pictures in the reader's mind that you want to control and to make change and move. So they're actually images, pictures. And when I've gotten it right, sometimes I'm not pleased because the rhythm of the sentence doesn't work. Or there's something off. And I'll give you an example. There is a sentence in Midnight that's almost right, but and it says the right things, but the rhythm of it is wrong. It occurs near the beginning of the book where I meet a man named Joe Odom, who's a piano-playing lawyer who writes bad checks and leaves his house open for all of his friends to come and use the laundry or raid the icebox. It's sort of a 24-hour open house. He's a very charming, marvelous person. And I first met him when he was in his backyard. His entire house was dark because he hadn't paid the electric bill. And he was on his knees with his electrical cable, and he was connecting it to the cable at the house next door. And there was a shower of sparks, and the lights in the house next door dimmed and went back up, and his lights all came on. And at the end of that chapter, I reflected on the fact that I had met a man who had just carried off a life-threatening, high-voltage act of larceny, which is what it was. But that sentence is kind of clunky. A life-threatening, high-voltage act of larceny. If I just moved some of that around, it would have come out a life-threatening gambit of high-voltage larceny, which is much more pleasing, and it's in fact a waltz rhythm. Not that I write waltzes and foxtrots and tangos in my book, but it has a more pleasing rhythm to it, and that's the way I like to write, because the reader, although the reader may not know, oh, that sentence has great rhythm, sometimes readers hear a sentence, and it should be have the right flow. I also like to get distance from what I'm writing and try to look at it fresh, as though I'm seeing it for the first time. And that's awfully hard to do when you just spend all day writing a page, to look at it with fresh eyes. I have, among my friends, people who are very good readers, who don't just say, oh, I love that, but they are very critical and helpful. But if it's 3:30 in the morning, you can't very well call them up. So when I was in Savannah, what I would do is to call my apartment in New York. The machine would pick up, and I would read the passage into the phone. And then I would hang up. And then I would call back and listen to my message. And now it was 900 miles each way, so it was 1,800 miles distance, and it sounded very different and fresh, and I could always tell what the passage needed, having heard it that way, and it was fresh to me. And I was telling this to Gay Talese, who is a marvelous journalist, and he's a new journalist, and he said, oh, I have my own technique. I said, what's that? He said, I take pages I've typed and tack them to the wall on the opposite wall of the of my office, and they go back, and I read binoculars. everybody, whatever works, right? I was asked the other day when I was talking to some students, what would you point out as some examples of good writing? Well, one of the hardest things to do is to describe somebody's face. Flannery O'Connor is wonderful at doing this, and I'm going to read you a few lines of description of people's face that she wrote. His face behind the windshield was sour and frog-like. It looked like it had a shout closed up in it. It looked like one of those closet doors in gangster pictures where there is somebody tied to a chair behind it with a towel in his mouth. Again. His neck was thrust forward as if he were trying to smell something that was always being drawn away. Another one. She jumped back and looked as if she were going to swallow her face. And then finally, besides the neutral expression that she wore when she was alone, Mrs. Freeman had two others, forward and reverse, that she used for all her human dealings. Her forward expression was steady and driving like the advance of a heavy truck. Her eyes never swerved to the left or right, but turned as the story turned, as if they followed a yellow line down the center of it. She seldom used the other expression because it was not often necessary for her to retract a statement. But when she did, her face came to a complete stop. Now, one more that I want to read to you. Edith Wharton whose writings are as fresh today as they were 100 years ago, in the age of innocence, describes the old Mrs. Manson Mingott, who is at the apex of society and very fat. The immense accretion of flesh, which had descended on her in middle life like a flood of lava on a doomed city, had changed her from a plump, active little woman with a neatly turned foot and ankle into something as vast and august as a natural phenomenon. She had accepted this submergence as philosophically as all her other trials, and now, in extreme old age, was rewarded by presenting to her mirror an almost unwrinkled expanse of firm pink and white flesh, in the center of which the traces of a small face survived, as if awaiting excavation. She was on a roll and kept going. Changed her image. A flight of smooth double chins led down to the dizzy depths of a still snowy bosom veiled in snowy muslins that were held in place by a miniature portrait of the late Mr. Mingott. And around and below, wave after wave of black silk surged away over the edges of a capacious armchair, with two tiny white hands poised like gulls on the surface of the billows. It's very inspiring and daunting to read things like that. After Midnight came out, I was given the key to the city of Savannah. Actually, twice. The mayor gave me a key, and then there was another election later, and the new mayor gave me a key, not knowing I had one, so I have two. I didn't tell him. I just accepted it. But I was casting around for another city to write about. Not city, another story. And I decided, I couldn't think of one, I couldn't find one. So I decided to be very analytical. And I thought, what made the first book work? And I knew there were three things: the location, the city, the wonderful characters, and the story. But I thought, I'll start with the city, because the main character of Midnight was actually Savannah. And I thought, what city in the world is as magical as Venice, as Savannah, but very different? And the first city I thought of was Venice, because I knew Venice pretty well. I'd been there a dozen times, and I actually knew people who lived there, but I didn't know about a story there. So I made plans to go there, and I went the 2nd of February 1996, but 2 days before I got there, by a weird coincidence, the Fenice Opera House had burned to the ground. Actually, the shell was left, but the entire inside was burnt to a crisp, was completely gutted. At first, it didn't even occur to me that that would be a core of a book, because I thought this will be reported and reported and reported and be very well known and chewed up, chewed over by the time I even got started writing. But that didn't happen. It was a one-day international story, and the Venetian press followed it very superficially. They took what they were given by the prosecutors and by the officials and left it at that. They didn't do any digging, any investigative work. And so I realized that this event, which was a tragedy for Venice, because they once had had 12 opera houses, and it was, of course, one of the birthplaces of opera, and particularly the Fenice, because five of Verdi's operas premiered there, and many, many other famous operas did as well. And it was a beautiful, gorgeous theater. But with the burning of the Fenice, they not only had no opera houses left, but they had no major stage for performing arts. So they were faced with the reality that they were actually a dead city. They'd been called a dead city for 200 years, ever since Napoleon defeated it at the end of the 18th century. But here now, without any place for a major stage for the performing arts, they didn't. Their arts, paintings, sculpture, buildings, had all been built 2 centuries before, if not 5 centuries before, but they had no living, breathing form of art. So it was important for them to rebuild the Fenice. And so the not only investigation into the causes of the fire was going on, but also the effort to rebuild it, which became mired in the most complicated and bizarre problems, and became slapstick. It became also, but it was typical of how things are done in Italy. So I didn't sign a contract then and there, but I worked for 4 years, spending about half of my time in Venice and half in New York, 4 years digging around for getting into that story about the Fenice, but also moving out and moving around Venice to find out other stories that were contiguous or at least going out at the same time. So that by looking at the Fenice and its aftermath, I could present a portrait of contemporary Venice. And I took 4 years digging around and asking questions and interviewing people. And after 4 years, I had something like 20 loose-leaf notebooks crammed full of interviews and research and whatever, transcripts of interviews. And at that point, it was the year 2000, I sat down and signed a contract to write a book on Venice. And I was given a deadline of 3 years, and I was only a year and a half late, which is pretty good for the book world anyway. I realized that by doing a book about Venice, I was actually not doing anything terribly new. No one had ever written a book about Savannah, really. So that was virgin territory. But my goodness, there are hundreds of books about Venice. And Henry James said in an essay in 1882, there is notoriously nothing more to be said on the subject of Venice. It would be a sad day indeed when there should be something new to say. I am not sure there is not a certain impudence in pretending to add anything to it. I even put this in my book at the beginning. and Mary McCarthy, 70 years later, in a wonderful essay, I should say that Henry James, having said that, then wrote two novels set in Venice and a score of wonderful travel pieces about Venice. Mary McCarthy, 70 years later, said in her book, Venice Observed, which is wonderful, nothing can be said about Venice, including this statement, that has not been said before. Well, this might have dissuaded a lot of people from writing about Venice. Not everybody, because people still do it. But I wasn't concerned, because they were both referring to Venice per se, the art, the history, the architecture, the travel aspects of it, and I was not going to write about that. I was going to write about people who lived in Venice, Venetians and expatriates. So I realized when I thought about it that all of the major novels about Venice were not really about Venetians. They were about people passing through. Death in Venice, Wings of the Dove, The Aspirin Papers, Don't Look Now, The Comfort of Strangers, Cross the River and Into the Trees, and on, Missler's Exit, and Equal Music. All of these authors used Venice for its marvelous atmosphere, its mystery, its romance. But they weren't writing about Venetians. As Henry James said in a letter to a friend, after a year and a half in Venice, I have not spoken to an Italian creature save washerwomen and waiters. Then he went on to say, the Venetian population on the water is immensely picturesque. In the narrow streets, however, the people are far too squalid and offensive to the nostrils. So he wasn't going to write about Venetians. And I was. And what did I discover? Eccentric people. Venetians live in a very strange world. I discovered once I'd been there for a long enough time that, in fact, while the city's very different from Savannah, of course, they share similarities. They are both isolated cities, isolated geographically, emotionally, culturally, historically. Savannah is on the coast, surrounded by piney woods and marshes, and Venice is in the middle of a lagoon. Savannians don't care about what happens outside Savannah. They never go to Charleston, which is less than 2 hours by car. I know several middle-aged Savannians who've never been to Charleston. Venetians don't care for anything that happens outside Venice, and if you were born outside Venice and moved there as a three-year-old, you're not Venetian. And in fact, they are Venetians first, and Italian second. They were, for 1,000 years, the Venetian Republic, an independent republic of Venice. It wasn't until the middle of the 19th century that they became part of Italy. And they have their own dialect, as all the localities do in Italy. Nonetheless, Venetians have their own culture, their art, their architecture. They look like no other city. They're arguably the most beautiful city in the world, or certainly one of the most beautiful cities. And Savannah is also a beautiful city. So they're both, what they are is enclosed universes. they are bubbles. And for a writer, that's wonderful, because when you write a story that takes place in a self-contained world like that, it's much more vivid. It takes on a greater atmosphere. And so it helps in writing a story or a book. If you're a reader, it's also an advantage because you feel you are escaping into this other world. So it works both ways. Anyway, I found these eccentrics. A man who walked around Venice selling plants, and he would carry them on his shoulders, strap them to his shoulders, and he all over. And he looked like a moving shrub, a very funny, charming guy. I'm going to read you, actually, about one of these people that I met. This is the passage I will read from Falling Angels. I was at a costume ball during Carnival. I had been invited by my landlords to attend this function. It was just Venetians were there. And there were about 300 people. And it was a beautiful palace on the Grand Canal, the Pisani Moretta. And there were cocktails. And then people sat down anywhere. It was not a seated dinner. It was seated, but you just picked any seat you wanted. And I found myself at a very interesting table. Seated on my other side was a man who exuded confidence and introduced himself as Massimo Donadon. "I'm a chef," he said, speaking to me and to the woman sitting between us. "My cuisine is known around the world." "Really?" the woman said. "Are you famous for a culinary specialty?" "Yes," he said. "Rat poison." The woman drew back. "You're joking." "No, it's true. I make the world's best-selling rat poison. It's called Boca Raton. Rat's mouth, or mouse's mouth, like the city in Florida. I never understood why anyone would want to live in a city with such a name, but it's perfect for my specialty, which I sell all over the world, in Dubai, New York, Paris, Tokyo, Boston, wherever there are rats. I have 30% of the international rat poison market." "What's your secret?" I asked. "Oh, my competitors approach rat poison the wrong way," he said. "They study rats. I study people." Signor Donadon pointed at my plate with his fork. "Rats eat what people eat." I glanced down at my fegato alla veneziana and suddenly saw my dinner in a new light. "Venetian rats would be very happy to eat what you have on your plate," he said, "because they're used to eating that kind of food. But German rats would not be interested at all. They prefer German cuisine, Wurstel, Wiener Schnitzel, that sort of thing. So for Germany, I make a rat poison that is 45% pork fat. My French rat poison has butter in it. For America, I use vanilla, granola, popcorn, and a little margarine, because Americans eat very little butter. For Bombay, I add curry. For Chile, fish meal. Rats are very adaptable. If their hosts go on fad diets, the rats go on the diets too. I maintain 30 research stations around the world so I can update the tastes and flavors of my poisons in order to make them consistent with the latest trends in human dining. What's in your Italian rat poison?" I asked. "Olive oil, pasta, honey, little espresso, and Nutella. Especially Nutella. Rats love it. I buy tons of it. I told the Nutella company I'd be happy to endorse it on television." And they said, "Oh, God, no, we beg you, please tell no one." The woman sitting on the far side of Signor Donadon put both of her hands flat on the table as if to steady herself. "I simply will not listen to a discussion of rats while I'm having dinner," she said. And then, as much in the spirit of melodrama as anger, she turned her back. Signor Donadon continued unperturbed. "Everyone is fascinated by rats," he said, "even people who say they're not. What they really mean to say is, oh, that's disgusting. I can't bear it. Tell me more." "But if a rat is hungry," I said, "won't it eat just about anything?" "Absolutely," said Signor Donadon, "but rats are better fed than ever, because there's more garbage than ever. So they've become very choosy about what they eat. In the 1950s, people used to throw only 0.5% of their food into the garbage, and rats had to eat whatever they could find. Today, 7% of our food ends up in the garbage, and it's a never-ending banquet for rats. The challenge for me is to make my rat poison more appetizing than garbage. Garbage is the real competition." "Rats are smarter than men and better organized, too," he went on. "They have instinctive rituals designed to ensure the survival of their species. For instance, Whenever rats find something that looks like food, the oldest rats always eat it first. Other brands of rat poison cause immediate pain, a burning sensation, or dizziness. If the older rats display any ill effects, the younger ones won't touch it. But Boca Raton outwits them. It causes no pain at all when it's eaten. It takes 4 days to have an effect. And by then, the younger rats have eaten it too. Tell me, said the woman to my left, how does the person decide to devote his life to the killing of rats? Ah, senora, said Donadon, when I stood at my grandmother's deathbed, she made me promise to make a contribution to humanity. When I was a boy, I decided I would find a cure for cancer. I knew that DDT caused cancer, so I went into several butcher shops and told them I was representing an American company that made insecticides without using DDT. It was a total lie. I said, I will get rid of your flies. The first butcher I called on said, if you can do that, I'll pay any price. Flies were depositing their eggs all over his meat. It was a disaster. I picked a number out of the air, and I said, it will cost you 30,000 lira, $15. And he said, do it. How did I kill the flies? I used a phosphorus compound made by Mount Edison. If you used it today, you'd probably go to jail. It's too toxic. But it worked. Business grew. People heard about us. I got a call then from Count Borletti, the sewing machine king, and he asked me to rid his stable of flies. One day, Borletti said to me, Massimo, what are you going to do in the winter when there are no flies? Killing flies is a seasonal business, but rats are a pest all year. You should consider making rat poison. What a brainstorm. That very night, I started experimenting in my bathroom sink. I mixed 10 pounds of pork fat and coumarin with my bare hands. That was 1970. We were an immediate success. I admit that killing rats may not be as noble a profession as curing cancer, but at least I'm making a contribution to humanity, and my grandmother can rest in peace. Donadon handed each of us his card. The company's name was Braun Meyer Deutschland. I thought you were Italian, I said. Oh, I am. But if I had given my company an Italian name, people would think, this product was made in Italy? I don't trust it. Italy has an image of being nothing but mafia, tailors, and shoemakers. On the other hand, Germany is solid, scientific, and efficient. If anyone could be counted on to kill a rat, a German would be the one. So I chose a name that sounded very German. Meyer is the equivalent in German of Smith. Braun reminds you of Wernher von Braun, the man who designed the rockets that took men to the moon, and that gives you confidence. The umlaut over the U shouldn't be there, but it reinforces the Germanness of the name, so I put it in. And Deutschland speaks for itself. Very shrewd, I said. Signor Donadon began eating his dinner, and I turned to the woman seated on my left and became involved in a conversation about, I think, the Fenice fire. Whatever it was, it did not last very long, because after only a few minutes, I heard in my other ear the word rat again. To be precise, I heard the word Pantagana, which is rat in the Venetian dialect. Rats cannot vomit, Signor Donadon was saying. They are one of the few species on Earth that are physically unable to throw up. However, if people, cats, or dogs eat even a single gram of my poison, they vomit immediately before it can do any harm, so it's safe to use. The woman who had sworn she would not listen to talk about rats during dinner had swung back around and was now facing Signor Donadon completely entranced. But if hundreds of thousands of rats die at the same time, she said, won't they decompose and cause the plague? My poison dehydrates them, he said, patting her hand in reassurance. It dries them out, mummifies them, so they don't rot and there is no plague. They bite people, don't they, she said, wrinkling her nose. The idea horrifies me. If a rat bit you, said Donadon, you might not even feel it. Because I'd be in shock, she said. No, you wouldn't feel it because rat saliva contains an anesthetic. One of the cabinet ministers, Riccardo Mizzazzi, was asleep in bed one night recently, and he felt his toe itch. The itch got stronger, and when he turned the light on, he discovered that his toe had just been gnawed off by a rat. Signor Donadon seemed prepared to go on in this vein for quite a while, but the other guests were stirring. There's just one thing I wanted to ask you, I said as I rose to leave the table. If your poison is as effective as you say it is, why are there any rats left in Venice at all? Very simple, he said. Venice doesn't use my poison. The town council always awards contracts to the lowest bidder, so I don't even bother submitting a bid. I'm prepared to make my contribution to humanity, but, Dona Dunn winked, humanity must be willing to make a contribution to me. One rather important difference between Savannians, in fact, Americans and Venetians, is that Venetians are very happy with gray, with shades of gray, whereas we prefer black and white. We need to know definitely what the score is. They don't need to know. For example, in the trial of the arson trial of Fenice, two young men were charged with burning it down, and they were convicted after 7 years of investigation and trial. They were convicted, and I went to the session in which the judge sentenced them, and he sentenced one of them to 7 years and one of them to six. And then he said something remarkable. He said, "These two young men were not alone. There were others in the shadows who were responsible and paid them to do it. They were people for whom the destruction of the treasure of the Fenice was nothing compared to what they stood to gain from it." He didn't say anything more. So, and I was amazed. I went to see him after the session, and I said, "How could you say such a thing? There was no evidence entered into the record." And he said, "Well, it's just the way I think it happened, and the other two judges agree with me." So I thought I should say so. And I went then to see the prosecutor, and the prosecutor said, "Well, I have told you that I've been looking for perhaps people behind this and who had paid for it, but and I had a suspect, the father of one of the young men, and I thought he was the link to the money, if there was any money. But he's just died of stomach cancer, and so the trail is cold, and we're not going into it any further. 7 years is enough, and now we have more important things to do. There are terrorists we have to watch out for." So that was the end of that. The next day, I had lunch with a good friend of mine there in Venice, Ludovico De Luigi, who is a wonderful artist, and he's a provocateur and a very shrewd individual, and actually has a wonderful sense of humor. And I said, "How frustrating. 7 years of investigations, long trial of many months, you have a conviction, and then the judge says, 'Well, there were people in the shadows, we don't know who they are, but they're responsible.' How frustrating," I said. "What a terrible way to end it." He said, "On the contrary, it's the perfect ending for Venetians, because we like to make up the truth on our own. We would have supplied our own endings, and now we're told, 'Go ahead. We don't know who did it, so it's perfect. We don't care. We know that it was burned down. That's the important thing, and these two guys did it.' But it's wonderful just to wonder, just to sort of figure in your mind who these people in the shadows, nell'ombra, who they were." So that is a major difference. We have to know. They don't really have to know. Thank you. Are you happy to answer questions if you have them? Yes. It is sold in hardcover, 2,700,000, and in paperback, 800,000. And then in Europe, if you add it all up, somebody figured out it's about 5 million in the world. Yes. The southern accents in the movie were the worst I ever heard. They didn't resemble any southern accent I know. And you know there are many southern accents. There are, you know, dozens. Savannah has its own. And my ear is attuned to it. I didn't hear it anywhere in the movie. And they had a coach who taught them how to speak with a southern accent. Kevin Spacey's was bizarre. It was nobody under. I mean, all the Savannians were laughing. It just wasn't. Yeah, will you tell her? I agree. And so does everyone I know in Savannah. Yes. Have I stayed in touch with the characters? Yes. I stayed in touch with Emma Kelly, the lady of 6,000 songs, until she died. I'm in touch with Sonny Seiler, who owns the Georgia Bulldog. I'm in touch. I haven't lately talked to the lady Chablis, but we are in touch. Who else? Jim Williams, of course, is dead. Various others. Yes, I try to stay in touch. Yes. I haven't chosen what I'm going to do next, and it's beginning to bother me because I want to get started. And actually, once I've made a commitment to do a book, then the fun starts, the research. The research takes most of the time. for me. And if I were to write a novel, it wouldn't. I mean, you do some research, but then you go ahead and make it up. But I want the story to be one that pulls you in, and then maybe it's in a remarkable place with wonderful characters. And the Time magazine, after I brought my second book out, said that I paid me a compliment, said I'd become a world-class weirdo magnet. Now, I hope that's true, because then that means they come to me. Yes. Yeah. This was in the prologue, because I thought it was important to put it there. I was walking along with the Count Girolamo Marcello, whose family has been in Venice for 1,000 years. And he said, all Venetians are acting. We all play roles, and the roles change. And he said, how do you see a bridge? And there are 450 bridges in Venice, going over them constantly. He said, do you see a bridge as an obstacle, a set of steps to get from one side of a canal to another? Because we Venetians do not. We see bridges as transitions. Our roles change as we go over bridges. You go from one reality to another reality, from one scene in a play to another scene in a play. And he said, and we were just approaching a bridge. And so we went over the bridge. I didn't feel any different from one side to the other. But I looked at him to see if he would acknowledge that he was now suddenly in another role. And he turned to me and he said, Venetians never tell the truth. We always say the opposite of what we mean. And what he was getting at was, it's part of that vagueness. It is true, as Mary McCarthy says, everybody thinks when they go to Venice, they're the first person to think it looks like a painted stage set. And it does. I mean, the 19th and 20th centuries are not even evident there. They're all old, old buildings, and they're weathered, and they're gorgeous, and they're beautiful, and they look like painted stage sets. And as Venetians go through the city, they feel as though they're players on a stage, and they're acting out their dramas, and there is something in the... It is a stimulant to the imagination. As Lord Byron, who lived there for 2 years, said, Venice is the greenest isle of my imagination. So they do play roles, and there is this exaggeration, the embellishment of... in fact, somebody said to me, you should Venetians always embellish, and if you just are known to just tell the actual truth, you'll be thought of as a bore. There's an extreme example in my book, a character I met, a person I met, a real person, of this role-playing. And somebody, I was on a Vaporetto, a water bus, and when it docked, it was a conductor on the landing stage, and he was waving it in and gesticulating. It was a sweet man, but it was the first time I'd ever seen a conductor wave a Vaporetto into the dock, because it's very simple to dock a Vaporetto. It's like parking a bus. Anyhow... And I thought it was kind of unusual. And he saluted us when we came off, and people addressed him as Capitano Mario. Mario. And a few days later, I was in a bar, and I saw a policeman standing at the bar in uniform drinking. I thought, how strange. But it was the same guy. And another time I saw him as a fireman. And as a pilot. And once I saw him as a prison guard uniform. But he was someone who actually sort of believed he was that person when he was wearing that kind of uniform. So, I mean, there is, and that's an extreme example, but there is a tendency to let your imagination play and the theatricality of Venice is very prominent. And the cover of this book I love for that very reason. People know that this book is about the Fenice fire, and they think, oh, that's the Fenice. Well, it looks like a proscenium arch, but in fact, it's an arch in St. Mark's Square, one of dozens that, ring St. Mark's Square. But it is indicative of the theatricality of the place, and that looks like the curtain's either coming up or going down. It's kind of mysterious. So that's why I love it, because it does speak to that aspect of Venice. Yes. It was amusing. I got to interview the serious guest that he had on. I worked for him for a couple of years. That's to say, the writers, the politicians, the scientists when they came on. Not the showbiz people. A couple of movie stars. But he's very bright. What I was doing was writing an interview. I would interview the people first, write the questions and the expected answer, so that Cavett would have something to go on, whether he followed... question by question. He never did exactly, but he used a lot of the questions. That was, and it was fun. But it was ultimately not satisfying because I wasn't really doing the final bit. So that was an interim thing. But it was it helped me sharpen my interviewing skills. And I these two books, I was able to do these two books by, when I interviewed people, by making the interviews more like conversations. And I would tell stories and ask for them to tell stories. And before you knew it, we were both very relaxed. And they were telling me everything I wanted to know. And there was always one or two really tough questions, embarrassing questions that I wanted to work around to and then ask. And usually I didn't have to even ask because the answer would fall out without my asking. But that's how I interviewed. Now, people have asked me how I remembered such long conversations, like the one with the rat man. Well, certainly when I was at this very lively banquet, dance, ball, I wasn't able to write down every word. But what I did do immediately, I took out that little pad and I put it on my knee under the table and would write single words and phrases down. And he gave us his card. So I then called him up and I said, can we get together? I love what you were talking about and I want to know more. So we had dinner a couple nights later and I went over the notes that I had and he filled in what said exactly what he had the night before and then some. So that's how that whole interview came. It wasn't exactly the conversation at the table, but very close to it. So that's how that worked. You reconstruct these things. Yes. Yeah. What was the effect of the chapter in my book called The Last Canto, which is about the papers of Olga Rudge, who was for 50 years the mistress of Ezra Pound? Without going into the whole story, these papers were perhaps mishandled. The old woman was in her 90s when they disappeared. They were expropriated. It's too long to explain the whole story, but it's a chapter in which a couple by the name of Philip and Jane Rylands, she's American, he's British, he's the director of the Peggy Guggenheim collection in Venice. They would cheerfully kill me. They wanted to sue me. They went to a lawyer and said, we want to sue. And the lawyer read the chapter and said, there's nothing libelous in here. And because with all the experience I had writing for magazines, and every single issue of a magazine is read by a libel lawyer, so I knew how to write a very dicey story and not libel people. I also had all the people I quoted in it telling the story. And this is the only chapter I did this. I sent them their quotes and said, this is what I'm going to put in my book. Would you sign at the bottom where it says, I've been quoted accurately above and everything I told John Barrett is true. And they all signed it. But it's interesting because when the book was reviewed by The New Yorker, they libeled. The New Yorker libeled these two people, and I didn't. The New Yorker said, the most interesting story in this book is the one in which the head of the Guggenheims seduces and swindles the 90-year-old ex-mistress of Ezra Pound. Those two words are libelous. So they were sued. And I guess they worked out some deal. I don't know if there's any money involved. But 3 months later, The New Yorker printed a retraction, making it worse, by repeating the lie and saying it was inaccurate. We regret the inaccuracy.
What was the effect? On their status?
The effect on their status in Venice, remarkably, is that they're still he's still the head of the Guggenheim. I met several trustees of the Guggenheim Foundation. Who said that we wanted to get rid of the Rylands? They're not very popular anyway, but they're still there. All I was trying to do was tell what I thought was a wonderful story, and this story mirrors, in a way, it apes the Henry James story, the Aspirin Papers, which made it irresistible to me. I was like a dog with a bone. I wasn't going to give up that story. One more question, maybe? Yes. I go back to Savannah very often, and I'm treated like a superstar when I go. I walk along the street, and cars screech to a stop. Mr. Barrett, you want to ride somewhere? I said, no, thank you very much. Thank you all.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Francine Matthews, James McGreevy, Sina Jeter-Nasland, T.A. Barron, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on October 3rd, 2006.